Hello and welcome to Pale Reflections, a proud member of the Doof Network, where we reflect on Wildbow's most familiar work as it releases. I'm Ruben Morehouse.
And I'm Elliot Diebold.
And before we start, just a quick note. Happy birthday, Wildbow.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday. Great work this year. I guess we turned it into a performance for you a little bit there, but let's get into the chapter, shall we? Happy birthday, Wildbow.
Usually we plug Wildbow's Patreon and stuff at the end, but maybe send him a birthday
present. Yeah, send him a little birthday present.
PayPal as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you know, if you're listening to this show, you're presumably getting a lot out of his work, so consider sending him some birthday dollars.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. You can go to patreon.com/Wildbow if you want to find more info, I'm sure. So, we are here to talk about one after another, 10.B and 10.C. Let's get into it, shall we? 10.B is an interlude where we're in Melissa's head, or are we? it's a classic fake out. Wildbow makes us think we're in a Melissa interlude as she's kind of being snarky and annoying. And then she notices some strange eyes in the bushes outside.
This was great. I spent so much of my live read, like, talking about, Melissa fits into the use of the Verona artwork at the top because XYZ. It turns out it's all just bullshit.
Yep. You got by Wildbow. It's a great fake out as well because, like, Melissa's kind of been overdue for an interlude for a while, right?
Yeah. It wasn't just me, but like a bunch of people were sort of like halfway through Arc 9 being like, I think we're about to get that Melissa interlude, to the point where it sort of became a meme by the end of Arc 9. Now it's about to be the Melissa interlude, even though it doesn't make sense anymore.
Well, but the thing that I think is great about this chapter is the part of the story that Melissa is up to right now, I actually don't think there's that much to, she doesn't have that much to do, right? Like, we can see that she's continuing to play a part as the story evolves over the course of this chapter and the next chapter, but there isn't a huge amount, and so this kind of fake out gives us the opportunity to do a bit of Melissa interlude while then going on to do some other crazy stuff with Sig. It just works so well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the part of it that feels like a Melissa interlude actually sort of functions as one would, because Sig has this super interesting, he draws so much of his perspective from the people. Like, it's not like he's a cigarette that has cigarette eyes.
Yeah.
The tone of the prose changes a lot based on who he's around. It's like he's drawing more than just location from the people. So we get a bit of a Melissa interlude through the fact that it's all coming from Sig.
As
well as Wildbow just getting to meme on those of us who had turned the concept of a Melissa interlude into a meme.
great fake out, Wildbow. Good stuff.
So I guess we should get into Melissa as the subject of this first half of the interlude, because as you said, it just sort of opens on her like doom scrolling and bitching about her old friends, and just like you know, you're sort of immediately like, oh yeah, that's right, she's just the worst right now.
My favorite quote from that is what, she shouted back, annoyance giving the word three syllables. Like, I can't even imagine how incomprehensibly annoying this is. Like, it's so incomprehensible, I can't imagine how you could possibly turn the word what into three syllables. That's just how terrible she is. She breaks the laws of reality.
How do you do it?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of close, I guess. That didn't feel quite like three syllables. It just felt like long one or two syllables, but...
Just with a lot of vibrato.
What?
As you said, like, there's this... what's clearly a goblin outside her place. And, like, she sees it and her response is to just, like, throw a candle at it.
Yeah.
And then obviously the candle gets thrown back because goblins are hilarious. She responds to her mum with three syllable whats. She just throws shit as goblins. She's just like, she's just so toxic at the start of this chapter.
Yeah. I mean, Melissa's mum comes in to check up on her, and finds a cigarette that Melissa somehow failed to notice and clean up. Huh, interesting. What's going on?
This gaslighting that Sig is doing here actually worked on me for a bit, because I was like, she saw the cigarette and I was like, I could have sworn she threw the cigarette out. I had to go back and check. It was great.
Yeah. Isn't it so good? I didn't realize it at first. I was just like, oh, she fucked up. But when we find out it's Sig, it's like, oh my God, Sig, you might have just done the most helpful thing that anyone has done for Melissa, which is demonstrate to her mother that she needs more active parenting. Like, Sig, with his snarky manifestation of himself, is more helpful than anyone else has been to Melissa.
Yeah, although...
I don't know, fully intentional, but it definitely works.
Oh, yeah. I guess, I don't know. I'm curious to have more of a discussion about how good the whole thing is. Okay, so obviously, because you're right, Melissa's mom comes in. Mom Melissa comes in.
Yeah.
And she's trying to be, like, nice and supportive, and it just clearly isn't going anywhere. Like, any good energy you send Melissa's way just gets thrown back at you in spite. But then she has that quote about ending the pity party when she catches the cigarette, and it's just... I think you're right. It's what Melissa needs. I think Melissa's at that stage where she needs someone to just lay down the law. You know, she's not like Verona. Like, I think, you know, the last thing Verona needs is somebody to sort of control her life and decide things for her, whereas Melissa's making a pretty good case for that being exactly what she needs. But Melissa has all these moments where she talks about her mum not, like, listening to her, and I think there's maybe some validity to her claims. She's probably exaggerating them and twisting them a lot more than she should, but there feels like truth to me in this idea that Melissa brings up, that her parents weren't connected to any of her stuff, like the dancing or gymnastics.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it was like, oh, you just drop me off and go get coffee or something. Like, there's probably something to that.
Yeah, I think that's fair, but... I don't know. I mean, like...
Well, I guess it's more of a, like, Kelly-tier fuck-up than a Haywood-tier fuck-up.
Yeah, but even so, I don't know. What she accuses is her parents not caring about the stuff that she cares about, which, I mean, yes, is a problem, but it feels like she's just... And I think her mum picks up on this. It feels like she's kind of just digging for something to throw back, you know?
Yeah, that's fair. I guess I would argue it maybe speaks to the sort of way someone like Melissa can end up where she is. Because what happened was she maybe wasn't as comfortable leaning on her parents as you'd like her to be, because she didn't genuinely think they had some sort of connection or something. Like, there was a bit of a distance there. And, you know, that distance on the other side has led to them just sort of being like, because every time we've seen Melissa's parents, they're like, oh, you know, Melissa, she's going to turn it around, you know, chin up.
Yeah.
Everything's going to get better. Like, they've just felt like the lamest hype men.
Yeah. I can kind of see a story where Melissa kind of has this drive to prove that the things she's doing are worthwhile to her parents. And that leads to a cycle of, like, pressure that becomes pretty rough.
Well, yeah, just this idea that they're sort of all of their affirmations and their love for her felt like it was coming from this distance where they weren't, like, it was just because she's their daughter, not because she's Melissa, if that makes sense. I don't know. Like, I agree that she's blowing this out and making it, like, trying to turn it into an obstacle. I don't know. I guess it kind of relates to what Avery used to talk about, where, like, she just didn't trust her parents to help her as much as she would like to have, because they'd let her down in the past. And I wonder if there's a bit of that going on with Melissa.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah.
Maybe this is all just foreshadowing, you know, a mum stepping up. Maybe it's foreshadowing Verona's mum stepping up and doing a really good job, right?
Yeah, we can hope. We can hope. But yeah.
I made a good dream.
Melissa's mum definitely... comes off better in this exchange with Melissa, right? Comes off as being like, oh, okay, time to step up and be more active of a parent here, which obviously is what she needs.
Yeah, I think so. I just wonder if that underlying tension of Melissa not feeling like they actually care about her as a person is something that needs to be addressed.
Mm.
But yeah, no, you're right. I couldn't help but root for Melissa's mom. There's like this great line where her mom says something, Melissa just responds, ugh. And then her mom just goes, ugh, and holds a cigarette in her face. And she goes, this is ugh. Which is just such a great retort.
Yep. Yep. So on point. Although, you know, you don't usually insult our main man Sig like that, I don't think. But, you know.
I mean, look, I love Sig, but, like, cigarettes are ugh. Like, she's right.
Mm, yeah, that's fair. But, yeah, great work, Sig. You did well.
I think, yeah. Like, he was, yeah. Yeah, I do think this will hopefully help her having this at home.
Yeah. So, yeah, Melissa realizes when this cigarette returns again that something strange is going on and kind of confronts it. Sig silently mocks her and she ends up calling for help.
Yeah. Interestingly, she actually calls Louise, not the Kenneteers. Louise calls the Kenneteers, and you could tell she's pissed about that.
Yeah. I mean, come on, Melissa. They've saved your ass so many times. You know this. Let them help you.
Although in Melissa's defense, the Kenneteers are at like 2% strength right now because Verona's not here.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, it's she just refuses to learn, doesn't she? Anyway, it's great. Sig's personality and sass shines through so much in the first part of this chapter, even though he can't communicate verbally at all.
Yeah, this ability he has to emote through just where he puts himself is hilarious. Like, the scene where Melissa is constantly throwing him out was just great. Like, you could just feel the frustration every time she turned around and he's just sitting there.
Mm.
And it's like, he doesn't really have a choice, but there's just something so smug about the way he's just like, I'm right here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's got this kind of smug personality that manifests here in a very fun way.
There's this great bit where, as she's going through that thing of just constantly throwing him out, she turns around and he's sitting on the windowsill in the same position he was last time. And she just, like, yells, fuck you, at him. And then from downstairs, her mom yells, fuck you, Melissa, back. And, like, you know, there goes, like, I'm so mad at you. And it's, like, it just raises that tension. Melissa's response to this is just, like, flailing and punching the air. And then she, like, wheels on the cigarette. I just couldn't help but be like, God, Melissa, you just take the bait so fucking easily. Sig literally doesn't have to do anything, and he can make Melissa continue to dig a hole for herself with her mom.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty funny, though. Yeah, I don't know. Like, we have this scene where they start to talk with Melissa, and the Kenneteers, they still seem so eager to help Melissa. Like, I have to ask the question of how many times are they going to bend over backwards for her? It might prove to have been the right thing to do if this stuff comes to a head and it resolves with, you know, a kind of Averyism where Melissa's like, no, you guys were trying to help me. I'll be on your team. But for now, it kind of feels like they've done as much as they realistically should and then some, and Melissa's still just kind of not having any of it.
Yeah, well, it comes back to this thing of how long can you try to help someone who won't help themselves? Like, you know, Nicolette talked about it right back when she first was trying to help Melissa. It was like, at a certain point, for your own sake, you have to stop helping someone who doesn't want your help. I don't know. It does sometimes feel like we're making these little bits of progress with Melissa. I can't help but think it's worth... I don't know. We'll see. It's going to be... I mean, obviously, she's hanging out with them in 10.C, so we'll see where it goes from there.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll have to see, I guess, in the next few chapters.
Well, I'm curious why she was hanging out with them in that cabin, because that's like 2 to 3 days after this chapter. So, yeah, I guess, why is Melissa hanging out with, you know, the other Kenneteers in a few days? Like, that's going to be one of the first things I'm looking for in, you know, what we see next chapter, assuming we go back to this and don't head into some other rando interlude.
Yeah, we will have to see. But so, yeah, the Kenneteers here lay out what these options are for Melissa, and none of them are great. Melissa almost seems to be taking heed of the situation she's in.
Yeah, she's more responsive to these idea of options than she was last time they got laid out, I think. Especially because she, for some godforsaken reason, actually listens to Louise. Like, Louise is the one who's like, just shut up and listen. But I'm not 100% sure I understand all. So there's four options they give her.
Yeah.
Option one is just she keeps hovering around in Kennet, but as an aware, or as like as a half aware, like she is now or something. And then they were like, there's option two, which is basically two different versions of her becoming like a full on aware and having problems.
Yeah. Yeah. So option two is her kind of actively. I mean, even the phrasing of them as options maybe is wrong, because some of them aren't options. It's kind of like, this is what will happen to you if you keep going. It could be this, it could be that, but it won't be good, you know?
But I suppose the core of option, the two option twos, is that these ones will lead you to, like, you know, death or a fate
worse. Yeah, basically death. Being consumed by the practice.
Yeah, whereas, like, then option three is go live in Sergeant Hall, which will be fun. We can go see, we can see Melissa in the spinoff.
Yep.
And then, yeah, option four is this, like, can you just, like, make yourself forget, like, turn around, please?
Yep.
But yeah, no, you, as you said, like, none of these are good.
Yeah, they're not. Because Melissa's already passed the point where she can get out of this cleanly, right?
It feels that way.
I mean, they pay lip service to option four, which is the cleanest escape that Melissa has, but it definitely kind of feels like the ship has sailed on that. We see her try and do that at the end of this chapter, at the end of this part of this chapter, but then we see that she's still with the Geneteers next chapter, so presumably it's failed.
Yeah, I mean, probably. I mean, there's this interesting bit, and again, this is something I can't wait to see, like, you know, I assume our guess is like a Lucy chapter next or something, but like, how, like, Melissa leans into pills a bit in a sec. So how's that going to go? That seems like a whole new avenue of fucked up, depending on how she's using those.
Yeah, God. Yeah.
Yeah. We'll see. It's Melissa's very, she feels like she's on the brink at the moment. Like, she's got these four directions she can go in. None of them are great, but there's definitely some that are worse than others.
Yeah. Yeah. There's just no good options, right?
Yeah.
But it's worth pointing out, people have been touching on some other options here, right, that aren't any of these, that are kind of like, I mean, one that I think a lot of people are throwing around in discussion threads and stuff is Melissa becoming a witch hunter as an option.
Yeah, that's been a theory for a while. I remember we called that out as a prediction, like, in early Arc 9.
Yeah, which... seems like it might have a possibility of happening based on how this chapter and next one go.
Yeah, I found, actually, I was looking for something else to do with witch hunters, and I came across this. So when they first went to visit Louise, and the trio were learning about aware from Matt in like 3.9, he starts to talk about how aware work, and he mentions witch hunters. But one of the things he actually says before that is some families keep blackguards. Which are aware, who they keep unawakened because it's useful to have like a group liar, which makes a lot of sense. Like, if you have this group of practitioners, but you have one of you who doesn't have to tell the truth, that person will have very useful like scenarios when you're engaging with like non-practice bullshit. So I think that Melissa could maybe turn into the Kenneteer blackguard.
Yeah, true. They could use someone with the ability to lie.
Yeah, although, I mean, Melissa would have to undergo a bit of a personality change for me to think she's a good fit for.
Yeah, would she accept the diplomacy
position?
Effectively, what? Not only that, but like, the offer is, yeah, you can hang out with us, but we won't really tell you anything, and also you have to do what we say sometimes. Like, I don't think Melissa would take that option.
I assume part of, like, officially making her into a blackguard or whatever would involve, like, giving up on this idea that they're not going to, like, fully induct her. Like,
but she can't be fully inducted and become a blackguard, can she?
I mean,
she can't become, she can't awaken, obviously.
No, but I mean, like, if you're sort of accepting how involved she sort of becomes in all this, like, you can just start telling her stuff, right? Like, it's a bit like, I don't know. I guess we see so many aware who are hazy and forget things, but I wonder if, like, you can just sort of say, okay, we're going to, like, lean you fully into this.
Mm.
and offer some protections. Like maybe that's a way that being an aware can be less of an ordeal.
Yeah, I guess you get some protections in exchange for the practitioners that you're the blackguard of have to kind of take on responsibility for you.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So yeah, I don't know. It seems like a long shot, and like, yeah, as she stands, like, do you remember like Melissa in like arcs 2 and 3? She was like so friendly and she talked to everyone. It's like, if you could get that Melissa back, I think she'd be a great, like, but it's not who Melissa is right now. So
yeah. Yeah. I don't know. It's definitely not who she is right now. So we'll have to see, I guess. So yeah, Sig continues on his way, stopping briefly by the Parker table.
Yeah, this is like the first of a series of little vignettes of how the innocents are doing in Kennet at the moment, and the answer for all of them is essentially not good.
Yeah, this is one of the things that I'm excited for about this arc, is like the idea of having a lot of interludes in this arc, which, I mean, seems to be what we're doing. Seems like each chapter in this arc is from a different perspective, right?
Yeah.
The idea of us, one, being able to see the plot from a new point of view, which is already cool, but also just getting like brief moments of humanity and backstory as we do in this chapter, as we do in the next chapter with Chloe. It's just so much fun. Like, I've always loved the things when Wabo has been able to just flesh out random stuff, like, you know, when we found out more about Clem's backstory, for example. And this is just more examples of that that I think is so much fun.
Yeah, it's just like, it's a nice little window into the parts of the town we don't get to see enough of in this story, like just regular people who are struggling and who are being made to struggle even more by all the karma and crap going on. Yeah, it's just something like it's the sort of thing you don't always get to do in a lot of stories. Like I'm again thinking of something like Korra versus Avatar The Last Airbender. Like I prefer The Last Airbender because it fleshes out the world more with episodes that just deal with regular people. And this is the like web serial equivalent.
Yeah. It's just so much fun. Should we talk about the Parker table stuff specifically?
Yeah.
So we get a very brief kind of little bit of Sig observing the Parker table, this kind of rough, loose support group of people, right? And I thought this was very interesting because Sig is obviously just kind of patrolling a bit, and so it's strange that he would stop here and spend time here. But obviously I got the vibe that this is just kind of a place that he checks in on every once in a while.
Yeah.
And so the question that was raised was, what is Sig doing here? Why does he care about this? Is he feeding something off of their like grief energy or something? I think that was kind of maybe it. But then on my second read through, I had the thought of like, what if Sig comes here because he gets support from this group? You know, not actively because obviously he can't talk or interact, but he kind of is going there to do his own grieving or loss. I just thought that was a really interesting idea. We'll probably never find out Sig's full backstory. This is the closest chance we got, but we get hints that maybe there is a loss that Sig is going through the motions of grieving at least.
Yeah. It's a really interesting idea. I hadn't thought of that. It's hard to tell because he has such an alien experience relative to us. Like he, as we touched on, he seems to draw a lot from wherever he is or whoever he's around. And, you know, I think, you know, we talked right back when he was introduced in the emails, like he's this sort of embodiment of like what cigarettes are used for. Like I've never actually smoked a cigarette, so obviously I'm talking out of my ass here, but like, you know, they're used sometimes as like, you know, a bit of an emotional outlet or something.
Yeah.
Or, you know, this centerpiece for conversations and stuff as they're used here. So you can sort of see how he'd get something out of like a bunch of people supporting each other in this way, like in a very emotional way, while using like cigarettes as part of that bonding. I don't know.
It's interesting. Yeah, but I wonder how much we can ascribe like those kinds of emotions to him. Is it possible that he has experienced some grief and loss, or is it just a manifestation of who smokes around town kind of impacting on him?
it could be that he chases that sort of thing. Like, he wants to experience it, you know? Mm. Like, you know, like, any strong emotion of any kind could just be something he's after.
Mm.
Because, like one of the standout things from the Parker table is this guy is... I mean, the whole thing's obviously very, like, melancholy because they're all, like, grieving. But there is this sort of heartwarming purpose that the main guy gets from, like, helping others at this table and supporting them.
Mm.
And maybe Sig really likes that feeling.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I wonder. I wonder. He's just so enigmatic, you know? It's hard to know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like, yeah, it's just hard for me as well because I don't smoke. So I'm definitely projecting my concept of like what smoking represents to people based on like what I've seen and what I've seen on film.
Yeah.
We need like Joy the Joint. I'd have more to say about her.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. So, So after stopping by the Parker table, Sig moves on to visit Matthew and Edith, kind of delivering his report on the goings on around town. And we see some clear delineation between Edith and the GBC.
Yeah.
And I think this is the real insight we get from this whole chapter is, I guess I had kind of assumed that Edith and the GBC were more of a singular mind than they appear to be. Or the key thing being the GBC, when it leaves Edith's body behind, becomes quite different, right? When we saw GBC chasing the Kenneteers after the fur theft, that was kind of had a different vibe to Edith, right? And we know that the GBC left her body on the night of the murder. So it almost is setting up this dichotomy to me of like, when the GBC and Edith are together, we see the Edith that we know and kind of like. But when the GBC leaves Edith behind, she also leaves behind her humanity and compassion and becomes a bit more of a murderer, I guess.
Yeah. And like people have speculated on this sort of thing for quite a while. But I think, yeah, this is the first time you really feel how different she is.
Yeah.
Personality rise when we refer to the girl by candlelight against Edith. Like,
yeah.
Again, we called this out as maybe relating to Edith way back when it happened. But when we had Metaphaos in 8.1 talk about those gods who just lacked a bit of humanity, and you could kind of see it feels like the girl by candlelight leans on Edith for a lot of her humanity in some of these ways, like empathy and stuff. Maybe I'm jumping ahead a bit, but like, yeah, I guess we'll get into that more later. But like, something I couldn't help but think was like, do you think this is a dichotomy that they've just been playing down in front of the Kenneteers, or do you think it's maybe also something that has gotten more defined since the explosion at the end of Arc 9? Because that separated Edith and the girl by candlelight, and it hurt Edith. The girl by candlelight was having to use wax to fix Edith up. So like, is this a separation that is more pronounced since Verona blew them up?
It's a good question. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe the explosion has weakened Edith to the point that the GBC is more taking the reins here.
Yeah, like she comments on how there's not much Edith around, and like you sort of assume that's because, you know, Edith's more or less dead, but the explosion probably didn't help.
Yep, yep.
They talk about McKay here. And basically say, you know, he's been bound and sworn by the conditions that Lucy laid out, which is like he has to go after shitty cops and lawyers and sort of bring them down as he gives them their life back.
Yeah.
And Edith sort of comments on how that's like a really heavy karmic load. It's an interesting wrinkle to what I was kind of really liking as a solution to the problem of how you deal with McKay existing. Because I don't hate it as a system. But if he's going to get shat on by karma and end up like Charles, like that's rough.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. Gosh.
Like it's one of these things. It's just the more you analyze it, the more I keep coming away with like, there's no winning scenario here. And I hate
it. No, it's all pretty rough, isn't it? There doesn't seem to be anything really positive that can come out of the way this stuff is going.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ugh. Yeah. Yeah. It's weird. Yeah. I don't know. it just feels like, yeah, it just feels like things are going to go badly. I guess we've known that for a while, huh?
Yeah, this is probably 0.0 thereabouts.
Yeah, so Sig then heads off to kind of continue his patrol around town, keeping an eye on the more vulnerable citizens of Kennet, and he finds an other preying on some youth. He goes and quickly warns Edith, who then goes and takes care of the problem.
Oh, well, yeah, she does. Yeah. This poor girl, I mean, she had a really cool aesthetic. She's like fucking steampunk cyborg, clockwork woman. And Edith just, yeah, I mean, again, it's that thing without Edith, the girl by candlelight, Jeebies, she just felt heartless.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's interesting as well, because like the girl by candlelight is born of human emotions a bunch.
Yeah.
Like one of the defining spirits that was called out in when how she was created was like people mourning at a candlelight vigil for someone who died in a car crash. You think she'd have more empathy?
Mm. Yeah, and it's weird, isn't it? I mean, like, because we see when the GBC finds out about Melissa taking pills, we see a very strong emotional reaction to that, right?
Although she separates herself from it, she does go like,
that's Edith's reaction. Like, yes.
Yeah.
I noticed that too, but it's still clear that Edith's, I guess, like moral compass, I guess is what I would call it. That doesn't necessarily 100% track, but I think it's an okay metaphor.
Yeah.
It still obviously has a strong impact on GBC, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know. Like, yes, GBC is horrifying in this scene when she murders this other, who's kind of committing crimes but seems to be almost repentant and desperate, and Edith's judgment is no, not valuable enough, you die. Yeah.
Like, that's the really shitty thing, is this girl is like, I'm desperate, I need to do this to survive, please, I'll do anything, like I'd love to come here, like,
yep.
She actually seems like exactly the sort of thing you think Kennet is meant to stand for. And yeah, girl by candlelight's just like, you do this? Yeah. It's like, we don't need a healer. Fuck you, you're dead.
Yeah. And I mean, they do. They kind of could use a healer, right? GBC is making decisions. You could
always use a healer.
Yeah. GBC is definitely making decisions without the best interests of the community at large, right?
Well, yeah, and absolutely not standing for what Kennet at its face claims to stand for.
Yes.
Yeah, it's brutal what she does to this poor girl.
Yeah.
Just to jump back a bit to like the whole, like, you know, because obviously we know the girl by candlelight needed Edith for some permanence.
Yeah.
And then also she's maybe leaning on her for like some of this like humanity, her heart or whatever.
Mm.
Makes you wonder, like, the girl by candlelight could be really bitter about a lot of that, right? Because, you know, this is, like, I hate this whole idea that others are always having to lean on humanity to be better, because it's so, well, I mean, that's part of what's wrong with the Seal Right, is it defines, like, human as good and normal.
Mm.
And it's, like, forcing a lot of the others to be like, oh, you need to lean into humanity to be more accepted and okay in this system.
Yeah.
So I guess I can sympathize a bit if the girl by candlelight thinks this whole situation is shitty because she needs to rely on these things that she can get from Edith to survive.
Yeah. 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 I am so struggling to accurately pin down what we know about GBC/Edith's character. It's just so, you know, we've talked a lot about what would be the resolution of this and the fact that we don't think it's going to come down to a secret villain, and I think the GBC is the closest thing we have to a secret villain that's kind of moustache twirlingly evil, you know.
Yeah, but I
but it's still, yeah, not even, it's obviously that doesn't not feel that, right? Yeah,
yeah, even that doesn't feel like a fair summary of her, because like, first off, she spends all this time in Edith, and we've seen how good Edith can be. There have been moments where Edith has been a better mum to the Kennedys than most of their own.
Yeah.
And even in this scene, the injured innocent girl, she heals her in mind and body using like one of her own echoes, which you could argue is like a pragmatic choice to sort of protect the innocence and part of her role in Canada, whatever the fuck. But like, I don't know. Like, she doesn't strike me as just this like heartless spirit.
Yeah.
As much as she's maybe leaning on Edith to like boost how much heart she has. Like she's not going to be the easy, mindless killing machine without Edith that we'd want her to be for a nice like wrap up to the story, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, for sure. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what, you know, like, I don't know what we're going to see from Edith. It's so hard to know what's going to happen. Well,
we still don't fully understand the motivations of Edith and Matthew and whoever else. Like,
yeah, not at all.
It seems like they're setting out to create one of these knotted spaces like Tashlit's brother had.
Mm.
Like they want Kennet kind of dragged into this, a bit of its own space that's Carmine bloody and not under the seal. But assuming that is what they're trying to do, I still don't fully understand exactly all the ways they think that's better. I can see, like, big picture. Like, oh, yeah, you know, without humans on top, we're not oppressed as much. And I'm like, okay, yeah, sure. But, like, I don't know, like, why this method specifically? Why the Carmine, you know? Like, it feels like there's little details that haven't clicked yet.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know. We'll have to kind of see.
Yeah.
So Sig continues watching over the town and sees a strange man asking about local myths and legends. Investigating, it becomes very clear that it is a witch hunter.
Yeah.
This witch hunter attempts to trap Sig, who narrowly escapes.
I'm already loving this guy as the Ark's, like, guest appearance villain. He's scary as hell. Like, you know, he figures out Sig in, like, a minute or less.
Yeah.
He like has Liz on the run, which is like Liz has been set up as our like experienced witch hunter killer.
Yep.
And I mean, obviously a big part of that was the fact that it was like groups of witch hunters that she could lean into for her copying, and this is a lone one, so it's a much better counter. But like he's established so strongly as a threat by like identifying something as benign as Sig so quickly and putting Liz on the run. I was just already like, oh, this is going to be fun.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of wild how quickly it feels like things degenerate here, because this witch hunter is like definitely very much an escalation, very strong, seems very scary.
Yeah.
Now, the trio have either killed or befriended everybody else who has learned about Kennet. So those are the options going in here, right?
Yeah, because he really strikes you as the diplomatic type, doesn't he, so far?
Yeah,
I mean, it's going to be interesting. We get comments later about how he's packing guns, which are usually more of a practitioner-focused thing than others. Like, so how does this guy feel about putting down 13-year-old girls? Is the question. I mean, I can't wait to get into this guy, because he's going to have a whole backstory as to how he ended up as this fucking, you know, badass Winchester brother type. I can't wait to see.
I don't know, like, you're right, the Winchester comparison is an accurate one, because this person just feels like a hyper competent witch hunter. Like,
yeah,
we're just in trouble. God.
When just like someone doesn't become a lone person, maybe it's just because I watched Supernatural, so this is where my mind goes, but it's like you don't become like a lone person carrying a fucking arsenal running around killing supernatural things without some sort of trauma in your past that has led you to go on this crusade. So it's going to be fascinating to learn what that is and see if that can be used. Like, yeah, is he someone who can be negotiated with? Or are they going to have to force him out of town? Or how does this... Yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
is he going to play off the stuff we're setting up with Crooked Rook and how unreasonable she can be?
Is there possibly a resolution to this where the Kenneteers talk to this witch hunter and reach some kind of agreement? I mean, the answer's no, right?
It'll have to be a journey and a half to get there, is what it feels like at this point. But we haven't seen him We haven't really seen him interact with anyone properly yet, apart from, like, you know, the kid who he got information off. So, I don't know.
Yeah.
He's going to be really fun to explore.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, we'll have to get that soon. I guess it's just kind of, there's this moment where it looks like Sig is about to get caught and who knows what. And just, God, that really scared me. Imagine if that had been the end of this interlude, Sig getting put into that jar and captured, like, fuck.
Oh, God. Oh, that would have been awful. Yeah. What a hype ending to the chapter, though. Fucking Operation Rescue Sig.
Yeah. But yeah, so Sig warns Edith about this, who dials in Liz. Those three discuss what to do. Edith gives them orders to stay out of trouble, warn their side, but leave the rest to fend for themselves.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to have a conversation about that, obviously, but just a quick shout out to how cool Sig's response to all this is. Like, he's fucking dashing around, burning some stuff in Edith's house, and like hopping over to Liz and then teleporting other places. Like, he comes dangerously close to feeling like an action hero, the way he's zipping around and getting people. Like, you can see what an asset he is in this chapter and in this ending in particular for, like, spreading information and making sure people are aware of stuff. I guess, like, as we're getting to the end of this chapter, I was thinking, God, whoever has Sig on side, he's actually a real asset. That's really good for them.
Yeah.
And then it was like a little bit later where it was like, yeah, okay, so Liz and Sig are definitely on Team Eden.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. When we learned that Sig was like somebody who did a lot of patrolling around Kennet, I was kind of dubious that he could be that useful, but no, he's great. He's like MVP of keeping watch over Kennet.
Yeah. And they've set up these great systems so he can actually report on everything, alert Edith. Like, it's great.
Yeah. So, yeah. Should we touch on how kind of damning this is? Like, we've gotten this whole chapter to grow to love Sig, and it turns out he's very strongly on Team Edith, as is Liz. I mean, that kind of sucks.
Should we call it Team Edith, or is it Team...
Team GBC. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry. Minor semantic bullshit.
Yeah, I mean, there is maybe a possibility that they're not on Team GBC, and they're being kind of actively manipulated, but it seems pretty unlikely.
Yeah.
Which means Liz and Sig are going to have to fight the Kenneteers sooner or later.
It seems like what it's going to be. I mean, it's interesting because it was in 9.1, I think, when Liz was like, oh, you got to watch out for the new others who want to be your friends because they could be trying to trick you. And it turns out that was actually her talking about herself, as we feared in 9.1. Because, unless we're grossly misunderstanding this conversation, it seems like this pretty much confirms they're not on the good side.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty rough, isn't it? And that's where the chapter ends, with us finding out that there are more people on Team GBC than we might have thought.
Yep, this arc does feel like it's doing a lot to start drawing the lines of where people stand.
Yeah.
Which is interesting, as you know, as we presumably begin heading into the climax.
Yeah.
We're starting to see the battle line, or where the battle lines will be drawn.
Yeah. We'll get a bit more of that in this next chapter.
Means I'm holding out for my Toad Swallow interlude.
Yeah, fair enough. We got to see those battle lines, don't we? Next chapter is 10C, perfectly named because we're in Chloe's head. So our series of interludes continues with Chloe's interlude. She is exploring the new home that she and Nibble have taken ownership of, and she decides to clean it up a bit.
Yes, we move from an extremely alien perspective to a heartbreakingly human one.
Yeah.
Right out of the gate, this chapter establishes how, limited Chloe is in this sense. Like, she's watching the sunbeam. The prose takes note of how she has to step around it. She has to worry about this and worry about that. It's like, immediately this chapter is establishing how much she has to be aware and be cautious, and it's not easy for her to do simple things.
It's pretty heartbreaking. I like how it unfolds as well, because the scene starts with us seeing this image of an abandoned warehouse with sunlight beams kind of breaking through the roof, which is like a pretty common image, I think. It's something that we've seen in media enough that we can kind of immediately picture it. But we as humans picture it in the way of like, you know, this abandoned factory is kind of dirty and messy and the sunlight is what's giving it kind of life and light and vibrancy. But obviously Chloe kind of has that thought too, but for her the sunlight is so bright and dangerous and terrible that it's like it really sets up any kind of rays of humanity that are breaking through actually are double-edged swords here, and that's Chloe's life.
Exactly. I mean, it's the same thing. Like, she's got this whole thing with her sight where it sort of functions as a life sense. And that's kind of, you get the impression that's meant to be because as a ghoul, she's meant to like lean into death more, but instead she does kind of use it to focus on life. But yeah, I mean, like, you know, that just the concept of that sight sort of encapsulates how she's been overtaken, where she needs to think of everything in terms of life and death now, and like shy away from the life, in as a general rule.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like the kind of theme of this chapter for Chloe is like humanity and the double-edged sword that it brings to you, and your other ship and the double-edged sword that brings to you, and whether you're willing to kind of give up parts of one for parts of the other, right? And those trade-offs. I think it's something that's so interesting to explore over the course of this chapter, that every possible decision that Chloe has to make has so many downsides for any meager upside that she might get.
Yeah, 100%. And that's why this chapter just continuously breaks your heart. I mean, there's also one point where Nibble mentions, he's like, it's a little weird and concerning how easy it is for us to feed here. Like, you know, there's so many dead people and dead others that are fleshy. Like, you know, this is great for us. And that's a bit weird. And I was like, that's very reassuring to hear that, because my concern with any other who is like doing well in the current situation in Kennet is like, well, they're going to be on the team who wants to keep that going, which I don't think is a good thing. So I like that Nibble is this sort of person who's like, it's a little uncomfortable that this is easy for us. Like, you know, that's not great. But like, God, you know, if push comes to shove and it's sort of like he needs to be asked to pick a side of, do you keep Kennet the way it is and keep it easy like this and it's violent, it's not great, or do you give up the closest thing you've had to a chance at an easy life? Like, not just for him, but for him and Chloe. I'm not going to be able to bring myself to blame him too hard if he decides to like go to Team Candlelight in order to keep it this way.
I don't know. It's I don't know. I mean, we see that they've kind of thrown their lot in with Rook in a bit, right?
True.
And it feels like that's because they are kind of invested in building this space as a safe place. But they
fuck knows exactly what Crook exactly, or their end game actually is. Yeah.
So I could see them again jumping ship to any of their possible teams. Like, it's
fully
understandable.
I could see them having the position of saying, this is better for us, but it's wrong, with this comment Nibble makes here. But also, if they didn't make that decision and they're instead like, no, we want to keep Kennet bloody, I'd be like, oh, that sucks, so we need to stop you, but like, I'm not going to blame you individually for making this choice. Like, and at least Nibble has the decency to be like, this isn't good. Like, at least hate yourself a bit while you're doing it, you know? He gets points for that. Not many, but some. I'm gonna be more okay with somebody who does this but isn't thrilled about it than somebody who revels in it.
Of course. I think it's great that these two ghouls have such a wholesome relationship. It's very like their interactions are very cute and romantic, but then punctuated within by Chloe grabbing and chowing down on a frozen arm from a young lady, right? Like, it's such nice moments of couple intimacy mixed in with very unsettling imagery.
Yeah. I mean, like, especially there's like a bit where she like romantically drops bits of fingers in his mouth.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of fun being had here with like them being the kind of put down struggling people, but they're actually the horror movie monsters.
Yeah.
I mean, the other side of this as well is it's not just any random frozen arm. It's the girl other that Edith killed in 10.B.
The TikTok girl.
Yeah. Fuck, that's good.
Thanks.
But yeah, like, I guess cause I'm just thinking about this because Chloe and Nibble tinfoil a bit on, like, why were we chosen to come here? Like, what ulterior motives could people have? What are they doing with us? And, like, this other girl, one of the things she mentions to Edith, oh, sorry, to the girl by candlelight as she's getting killed is, you know, she had this sickness that was spreading, and that's why she's replacing more and more parts of herself. And I don't know how it works with ghouls, but, like, depending on this illness or whatever, it's probably not good that they're eating, like, you know, rotten meat, essentially, right?
Yeah, I mean, I see that, and maybe Edith is using them or kind of poisoning them there. But I also just think it kind of gives me vibes that Edith is using them as her own private body disposal service.
Oh yeah, which is absolutely like a great reason to keep ghouls around and stuff. But like, yeah, I suppose while they're tinfoiling and thinking that they're not on the girl by candlelight's side, I can't help but notice that they just got a body that was dying because it was poisoned
to
be eating.
Yeah, so true.
I guess we'll see. Like, honestly, it'd be great if the reason that they were brought in was as a body disposal service, because that's kind of a win-win. I mean, not for the people dying.
Not for the people being disposed of, yeah, but, you know, they don't count. It's a win-win for the characters that we know.
Yeah, these other people don't have names yet, so they don't
count. Yeah. Yeah, so we don't have empathy for them. So, Chloe continues cleaning after a brief altercation with a sunbeam, you know, calms herself down and keeps cleaning.
Yeah, and like, again, just a heartbreaking perspective. This metaphorical sort of illness that she has, like, she maps in my brain at least very well to, like, a sort of invalid who, like, she's just being held back by her illness so much, and it hurts to read because she's like, she's doing things here like hanging these posters and trying to remember her, like, original life and her original self, but it's so distant from her now, and she's looking forward to days where she can go into the sun again in like 200 years.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she's got these changes happening to her bones, so her ribs are now spiky and they cut shirts she wears, like, it's just everything is just so stacked against her, and she just, it's heartbreaking and then also heartwarming how upbeat she is about a lot of it.
Well, yeah, I think it's worth just noting while we're on the topic of her internal countdown, she's kind of keeping track of how long she thinks it'll be until she can be the person she wants to be, and that's clearly giving her something to strive for. But this chapter demonstrates, and this kind of seems like a pretty ordinary day in the life for her, this chapter demonstrates that number is going up faster than it's going down, right? Like, she's not going in the right direction.
Well, yeah, she thinks about it a lot, but it's sort of, you know, one misstep sets her back a decade or something.
Yeah.
Like, it's, yeah.
And it's obvious that she's having, and it would be impossible not to have more than one misstep every 10 years, right?
That's what it feels like, yeah. Like, it seems a ridiculous ask.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things where the better she gets, the easier it is not to misstep. Like a ghoul who's gotten powerful enough that they can go out into the sun, it's way easier not to make the mistake of getting hit by a sunbeam if you can walk in the sun.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's like the further down you are, the harder it is to
try. Yeah, you're right. It is another good kind of privilege metaphor, which plays into the overarching themes of the story quite nicely. But yeah, I guess it's just kind of like, something has to give if Chloe can't think that this is going to be the way that things will go forever, because obviously she's going to get further away from that point over time. And so something is going to have to give mentally there.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Like, I'm kind of inspired by her own optimism that she can still have that hope of getting there. And I suppose you're right. That is something that could shatter. But the whole sort of vibe she gives off in this chapter is like her whole thing is she's cleaning this bathroom, and it's not just like a regular household bathroom, it's like a big, like, factory worker shower thing, so there's, you know, presumably like a dozen shower booths or whatever. Like, it's a big room, and she barely manages to clean out one stall. Like, she's got this little corner that she makes glisten, and it's like such a metaphor for her whole existence, where it's this giant, dirty, filthy room, and she spends all of her time and effort getting one tiny corner to look nice, and she's just able to stand back and like be proud of the fact that she made this tiny corner nice. Like, I don't know, I find that really inspirational, that she can take so much bad, make a speck of glistening in the darkness, and just be proud that she managed to do that.
Yeah, it is kind of inspiring, isn't it? It's very much like an inspiring mindset, I guess.
I want to put her in a room with Melissa.
Yeah, I mean, Chloe has it way worse than Melissa does, and is so much more optimistic and is so much more willing to work to get to the world that she wants to get to. I don't know.
Yeah, it's like what Nibble says a bit later, where like Chloe has that moment where she's like, I think I must have been a bad person. That's why these people did this to me. And Nibble's just kind of like, I mean, yeah, maybe, but like, I don't really see it now. And like, I have to side with Nibble after reading this chapter. Like, she strikes me as such a nice, like, optimistic person that I can't imagine she was that much of a dickhead. Of course, her reward for cleaning out this one corner of this dirty room, like, her reward for managing to find a bit of light in the darkness is the world shits on her.
Yeah, she doesn't get a nice reward, does she? So she, having cleaned up the shower, she steps in, turns it on, and completely ruins herself. She flashes back to her previous life. Nibble kind of dives on her and knocks her away, and she attacks him before she kind of comes back to her senses, and they recover beside the shower. But yeah, it's pretty fucked.
Yeah, it's just, yeah, like, again, as you were sort of saying before, this is Chloe's existence. She, even when she manages to make this light in the darkness, the universe beats her down for it and sends her way further back. I mean, as well, the sort of cherry on top of the suffering here is the only times we really see Chloe actually manage to connect with her previous life is in these moments where she's really suffering and losing control. Because she clearly, like, you know, she's hanging up posters of her old self, and she clearly wants to try and capture who she was as a human and understand that person better. But the only time she ever manages to do that is when she's like in pain and suffering. And that means the memories and flashbacks she's getting are like bad ones. Like, it's just, you know, like, the only parts of her previous life that she really remembers clearly are like her friends choosing to sacrifice her.
Yeah. Pretty glum, huh?
Yeah, it's rough.
Yeah. Yeah, the shower stuff is especially heartbreaking, because it's like a representation of the fact that the things that Chloe misses the most, or that separate her from her humanity, the kind of small comforts that she really craves, are also the things that hurt her and push her away from being able to enjoy them. Like, it's such a classic Greek tragedy kind of vibe.
Yeah. Well, it is such a great metaphor for living with a chronic illness like this, because that can be what happens, is, you know, when you, like, not speaking from personal experience here, just like anecdotal stuff, like, if you sort of try to chase beyond your limits something that you used to be able to do, or that, you know, should be quote unquote normal, like, it can, you know, exacerbate things and set you back and make things worse. And that just sucks.
Yeah. It's pretty, yeah, I don't know. It's pretty glum.
Yeah, like, the shower thing in particular is, like, hurts, because before it, Chloe has this whole thing where she sort of goes, yeah, you know, there's the three-part response I have, which is fight, flight, or freeze. And she thinks to herself, like, I never really get to do flight when I'm suffering. Like, for some reason, that escapes me, presumably, like, as a ghoul. And you see that in the shower, because the shower turns on and it starts destroying her, and she just doesn't get to consider flight at all, which would obviously be the choice, because she just needs to take like three steps and she's out of the shower. But like, her body doesn't let her do that in the moment, so she ends up freezing, which makes it worse, and then fighting, which just hurts Nibble. Yeah, it sucks. Like, she's not allowed to run away from these things.
Yeah, it's I don't know. Like, it just all compounds to be this unbearable pressure that is weighing down on Chloe with every aspect of, like, everything about her life compounds off of each other to make sure that there's just no escape from it.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, it's worth it. Well, not really, but it's nice for this scene in the shower afterwards where, like, Nibbles sort of puts his hands in and takes little bits of water at a time and, like, you know, sort of gives her a little shower, and it's this really nice moment. I suppose we'll get into the potentially less healthy parts of their dynamic later on, but it's moments like this where you really feel how good they are for, or at least how good Nibble is for Chloe. And, like, just the little bits of extra mile he goes to, like, cleaning that room while she's asleep. Yeah, I don't know. Like, the fact that she has Nibble in her life is huge.
Yeah, for sure. It's a very wholesome and nice relationship. Like, I don't know, maybe that's what Melissa is missing. Maybe that's the difference between Melissa and Chloe, is Chloe has Nibble.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I think there's probably more to it than that, but it's certainly easier in a lot of ways, yeah. Mm. You're right, Melissa, when she was a cripple, as she likes to say, she didn't really have a Nibble to help her. Oh, she probably had her parents, but yeah, who knows?
Yeah, plus it's not, I don't know, it's not the same thing, I guess.
Yeah, fair.
So yeah, Chloe wakes up and joins Nibble and special guest star Crooked Rook downstairs. the trio discuss patrols, miracle cures, and Carmine conspiracies.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to talk about here, obviously, but one of my favorite bits is one of the first things Rook does is go on a speech about how shit practitioners are, and Chloe sort of thinks to herself, Rook sure said a lot of things that sounded very right that Chloe didn't want to be true. Mm. And I love this as just a little summary of, like, Crooked Rook's whole propaganda sort of vibe. Like, I don't, like, Crooked Rook doesn't say anything that's untrue. I mean, obviously she literally can't, but like, the speech she gives here paints all practitioners as being absolutely bad and the absolute worst. And I mean, given what we saw at the Blue Heron Institute, that's maybe not necessarily super unfair, but it's so, when you've got, like, the candidates in town, it's so unproductive, I suppose, to just, like, paint. The way she phrases it is just sort of like, there is no hope except to fight them, rather than, like, acknowledging that, you know, there are people like the Kennedys. I don't know. It's just, yeah, the way Crooked Rook sells everything, she makes it out to be so black and white. And
yeah,
I don't think that's completely fair.
Yeah, I mean, it's subtle, but, you know, obviously Nibble and Chloe have had negative experiences with practitioners before, right? So it's probably pretty easy for Rook to play into that fear that they have.
Yeah. Well, and that's probably true of most others.
Yeah, so it's not that hard to make it seem black and white, even if Nibble demonstrates later in this chapter that he kind of likes the Kenneteers.
Yeah, yeah, which I'm sure is something Crooked Rook probably has mixed feelings on.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, actually, they're probably not very mixed. yeah, yeah. I mean, that's the other thing, is Crooked Rook touches on here this idea that, like, she's going to judge what side a lot of people are on based on how much they even listen to the other sides, which just rubbed me the wrong way, because it's like, I don't know, the idea that, like, you know, if you're not with me, you're against me. Yep. It's just never.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, if somebody's, like, hearing Bristow out, I'm going to be a little bit like, well, come on.
Yeah, but you're right that it's like the refusal to even accept that people that aren't you might have some kind of valid point.
Yeah.
It doesn't bode well for you being a reasonable person.
Well, it's already admitting that there's no way forward but, like, to fight.
Yes. Because
if you're not willing to negotiate, hear them out or whatever, you basically are saying you've already accepted that the only way forward is violence.
Yeah.
Or some kind of confrontation.
Yeah.
Yes, I think that's what rubs me the wrong way about it, is especially in Kennet, there's more to it than just practitioners evil, you know? Like, yeah, like, again, if the other side is Bristow, I'm a little bit more willing to, like, not drag the negotiations out because there is, you know, he's a piece of shit, but there's so much more to it in Kennet, and not even being willing to acknowledge people who see that is just shitty.
Mm. Yeah, for sure. We find out here that the ghouls are on Rook's side, and I like that the sides, as we've kind of touched on, are getting quite defined over the course of this arc. We really don't know what each side wants, though, do we? Like, I don't think we know what any side wants except for the Kenneteers, who just want things to be nice and chill.
Yeah, they just want, yeah, they're trying to move towards equality in a relatively peaceful way.
Mm.
I feel like we have these big picture general ideas of, like, you know, we know the culprits apparently don't want things to go back to normal, and we can see why they're against the status quo. And we know Crooked Rook is very against the status quo. But, like, these big picture things don't coalesce to me for very specific ideas of what each side's motive is.
Mm.
Like, even Crooked Rook, something that occurred to me in this chapter that I don't know that we've really talked about before is, like, what's her opinion of Matthew? He used to be a practitioner.
Mm.
I think we've seen them directly interact, but I'm not 100% sure on that. But, like, yeah, where does she stand on Matthew? Someone like Matthew?
Yeah.
It's like details like that like work into this whole thing where I'm just like, I don't know exactly where everyone is, and I love that. Yeah. And it is such a complex web of motivations at the moment.
Yeah, it's interesting. Matthew's practitionership is especially interesting question, I think. There's a lot of thoughts about how that might play into interactions like the Witch Hunter or like Rook, and so I'm just eager to see that eventuate over the course of this arc, I suppose.
Yeah, 100%.
So we get this offer from Rook to tweak Chloe.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Like, these are abilities we've wondered about since Crook was first introduced again. I feel like in these two chapters, I'm referencing the emails a lot, but it's like, I feel like we're finally starting to take a lot of these characters we introduced in those emails in Arc 8 and really explore them in these interludes.
Mm.
I mean, obviously, as it turns out, this isn't fucking miracle cure stuff, like you mentioned. There's no fix for being an other. Like, at best, what Crooked Rook does is let you choose your poison. It kind of reminds me of, like, drugs you can get with crazy side effects.
Mm.
You know, the sort of, have this drug which will, you know, help with the pain, but also watch out because, you know, it'll make you get crazy diarrhea or something. In a way, a lot of these things feel much more like lateral movements where you're choosing something that you feel is less debilitating than whatever you have.
Mm. Yeah. It's interesting because Rook is kind of making these offers that are almost inherently monkey's paw-esque, right? But Rook does seem very open about it. It's not a way to manipulate Chloe. It doesn't seem like it's a way to manipulate Nibs and their relationship. It's just kind of genuinely offering services in a way that I found kind of nice, I guess.
Yeah. Well, it comes back to, you know, some of that stuff we talked about with Jay. Like, she's not... She actually stands up for her ideals. Like, she respects their agency, and she, you know, yeah, she's not trying to trick them into being on her side or anything. Like, I love that Crook is very much like, this is an option for you. It will have these side effects. You know, I can do it for you if you want or not. Like, there's no, yeah, trying to trick them and have them owe her or something. She wants others to have control and freedom, and that's what she's offering them.
Mm. Yeah.
But almost more interesting than the mechanics of Crooked Rook's thing here for me was, like, well, Chloe's answer, where basically the thing that kind of seals the deal for her is that if they were to lean her into nature and give her or lessen the impact of some of the ghoulish parts of her, she wouldn't necessarily be able to see the horizon without it fogging over.
Mm.
And Chloe's like, I really want to be able to see the horizon. And when Nibble reacts poorly to this, she sort of says, I know I'm a burden and that I'm struggling and that you have to help me too often, Nib, but I need that.
Mm.
And like then Nibble starts to respond and he's like, you're not a... I don't mind helping, Chloe. I don't mind if you're a bit of a burden sometimes. I mean, I worry, I do, but it's... And I get the impression he's going to say it's fine, but then he has to stop because he can't lie.
Mm.
And like Chloe, you know, grabs the railing tightly. She's like wrapped with guilt. And it's just like, this is just this sort of carer relationship in a nutshell and why it like hurts to read it here. Cause it's, there's no winning here. Like Chloe can give up part of herself or feel guilty that she's doing this to Nibble. On the other side, Nibble, you know, we've seen from conversations with Nibble and stuff, a lot of where he's coming from here is guilt for what happened to Chloe too. Mm. He blames himself for a bit of it. And you can sort of, like, here, he wants to care for her. But for him, the choice is ask Chloe to give up part of herself or continue to kind of be stuck in this limbo where, like, you know, she's a burden. And, yeah, like, it just, it sucks. Like, both of them are losing in both situations.
Yeah, there's no, yeah, it's just a lose-lose. There's just no... Once they're in the position that they're in, once they've been screwed by fate to be here, there's no win. There's just less loss.
Yeah, yeah. Like it just, yeah, it sucks.
Yeah,
yeah. And I mean, I've sort of known people who have been carers for people with illnesses or whatever, and like I think this taps into that vibe very well of like. It's a loving relationship, but one that on both sides can kind of be steeped with senses of guilt and of like responsibility. And like, it's just a hard thing to have on your shoulders.
Mm.
I think the story does a really good job of capturing that vibe.
Yeah. 100%. It just captures the kind of hopelessness of it all, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. And I want to bring this back to Matthew and Edith a bit as well. Cause it just feels like, the comparison is there to be made a little bit. Like, obviously, I think Nibble and Chloe lean a lot more into this kind of carers metaphor, whereas Matthew and Edith are much more of just they always felt like a couple saddled with debt. But it, like, yeah, I again, it's like the girl by candlelight feels like somebody who Matthew did so much for to try and help, and we're really unclear. Like, she's clearly gone off the deep end a bit and is maybe pushing away from her humanity or. You know, doing all this bad stuff, whereas we've just been in Chloe's head and you can see like how much she's trying to use what Nibble offers to make herself and everyone else's lives better.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%.
So I guess once we know more about the girl by candlelight's motivations, is she doing the opposite or is this her twisted way of trying to repay everything Matt's done for her?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, like, obviously the positioning of these two chapters next to each other seems to very deliberately invite those kinds of comparisons. And I would say my sense is the girl by candlelight wants humanity when she's Edith and is happy to cast it off when she's not. Like, wanting to be human is a sign of humanity in a way. And I apologize to our other listeners out there because humanity is probably a bit of a loaded word, but like the others who are aspiring to be closer to humanity are also the ones that have the most humanity and therefore I kind of like them and trust them the most.
Yeah. Well, I suppose something else that always comes up in these conversations is like the concept of what part of humanity or whatever that an other is missing is very variable. Like with the girl by candlelight, it kind of feels like a heart or empathy or something is what she's missing, but that might not be true of another other. Mm-hmm. Like I think what's really interesting is it's not just like a scale. It's like this multi-dimensional thing.
Mm.
So with someone like Chloe, like what she's missing from her humanity is different to what the girl by candlelight is missing and goes without.
Mm.
Like their struggles are related, but not the same.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. I don't know. Like the girl by candlelight seems to be so much less concerned with, I don't know, like Chloe seems to be concerned with finding a nice place for herself, which I guess is what the girl by candlelight is concerned with too, but Chloe seems to be able to take that and abstract it out one more step, at least, to being like, okay, so if I want a nice place, other people might also want a nice place. What does that look like? Whereas GBC just seems to be like, I want what I want, and I'm going to do whatever the fuck I want to get it, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I get that vibe, but also I don't feel confident laying down anything about the Girl by Candlelight's motivations too concretely. God, hopefully we get some sort of Girl by Candlelight or Matthew interlude soon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So next,
the ghoulies go out on patrol and run afoul of a trap set by the new witch hunter. Luckily, they escape and run right into a hut containing our new 4 Kenneteers.
That's right. We're swapping out Verona for Melissa, I think.
Yeah.
About time, I say.
Yeah, exactly. Verona's dead weight. Bring in Melissa. She's fun and great.
I mean, the reveal of this trap is very fun. Like, this is a great scene of sort of, you know, Chloe and Nibble, like, having this interaction with this guy and being like, that was a little weird. And then things just continue to get weird before Chloe's like, oh, this is a fucking trap. And it's like, remember, she almost wasn't going to come. Like, thank God Nibble did bring her, because he's kind of clueless here. Like, he comes up and he's like, hey, look, there's salt. Well after Chloe's already sort of reached the point of like, this is a trap.
Mm.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah. I hope Chloe has the self-respect and insight to see that she totally carries the team here.
Well, the interesting thing about it, and another interesting element to this thematic dynamic between Chloe and Nibble and their humanity, is I definitely get the vibe that Chloe is so much better at this kind of part of the job, the sensing, the fighting, etc., because she's less human. She's less human and therefore has more of her other senses that she can rely on. So, like, Nibble is weaker than her in every way except being human.
Yeah, she struggles to survive more, so the idea of the struggle and the hunt or whatever is more natural to her, whereas, like, the defining thing for Nibble as a ghoul has been that he can get quite a bit of his energy just from watching TV.
So
he has these more docile avenues, and it's just probably made him a bit more docile.
Yeah, or you know, he's more domesticated, I guess, less able to survive in the wild.
He needs to watch more, like, X-Files and stuff, so that when he sees a fucking trap like this, he can figure it out. Yeah, I don't know. Overall, I just really enjoyed this as an action scene. Like, the chase through the forest where they're setting off bells and then getting, like, blind shot at by the witch hunter is very fun.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's fun stuff.
They're going to meet up with the Kenneteers, which is, I mean, part of me couldn't help but worry that, like, the witch hunter wanted them to get away so that they'd lead him to, like, more of the others.
Interesting.
So we'll see if that was a thing, because it felt, I think they got out of this too easily.
The witch hunter missed them when he was shooting at them. And as we saw from John's interlude, if a practitioner wants to, or, you know, anyone involved with the practice, they have tips and tricks up their sleeves that make them accurate with a gun.
I mean, yeah, well, because witch hunters are aware, they're not practitioners.
No, but presumably they would be able to rely on the same kind of tricks, I guess.
Well, yeah, he can do these bells and stuff. Like, he's clearly magically equipped.
Yes.
So, we'll see. I can't help but feel that he wasn't totally upset with them getting away, because it meant that they'll lead him to more people. And, of course, they've stumbled right into the Kenneteers, which is very fun.
Mm-hmm.
And Melissa, too. Let's not forget the new MVP.
Yep, new MVP, sure. It is a great setup, isn't it? So we've got our very competent witch hunter, and now the, in air quotes, Kenneteers. They're going to have to fight him with Nibble and Chloe's help. Hopefully they can pull in more reinforcements, because, like, I don't feel like this isn't a winnable fight right now. They need their other who knows about guns and firefights.
Yeah. Oh, God, John against a witch hunter would be very interesting.
Mm. But, like, the other thing to note is, obviously, this is a Veronalist conflict we're about to see, so it'll be fun to kind of keep an eye on that and see how it goes.
Yeah, well, yeah, and it's a Melissa-inclusive one, so...
Yeah, I guess that's a detraction rather than a benefit, obviously, but...
Well, I think with all the stuff of her becoming unaware, and, you know, obviously people have speculated she'll be a witch hunter for a while, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how she bounces off this witch hunter. Because I think, like, with Lucy and Avery here, they're going to try talking to this guy at some point. Like, that's going to happen. And I'm interested to see how that goes.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the end of our chapters for this week.
Yeah.
Who do you think we're going to get the perspectives of next?
Yeah, we did talk about this a little before recording, and I'm sticking with, like, Lucy as the prediction.
So we can see the conflict from Lucy's perspective.
Yeah, I think we've had three interludes in a row. This one's ended with us seeing the Kenneteers again. It kind of makes sense to me that we dug into Lucy's perspective for a bit, at least.
Okay, then the real prediction, who's going to be the second chapter we get this week?
I mean, obviously that's going to depend so much on how it goes, but...
I could see us having Lucy's chapter next to, like, continue this thread. We don't necessarily finish the conflict, but we jump away from it, cutting to, like, Tasha's perspective with Verona or something. So we kind of see how they're going for a bit before we cut back to kind of wrap up this conflict or kind of wrap up the after effects of it.
It does feel like it's only a matter of time before we jump back to Verona for a bit. I mean, we haven't had a Verona chapter since 9.9.
It's been a while, huh?
And, like, as quick, something we haven't talked about yet, but these chapters are moving through time a fair bit quicker than, you know, like, we've had entire arcs that were within a day. This one, like, Sig's interlude moves through about 3 days. So I get the impression that, you know, Verona's not going to be away on this trip for, like, 4 arcs or anything. Like, we'll probably, like, be with this witch hunter for a good chunk of the arc and then start time skipping a bit again, would be my guess. But we do need to go and check in on Verona and Tashlet at some point. I think an interlude I'd love to see coming up, especially while the fight with the witch hunter's going, is we've obviously already lent on John as a warrior recently. We haven't seen our other resident warrior, Guillemet, for a while.
Oh, yeah, true. He's taken a bit of a back seat lately, hasn't he?
Yeah, and, you know, he's got that fall to winter coming. I don't know how that plays off the witch hunter, but, like, yeah, that's something I'd love to see us get into with the witch hunter, is how Guillemet plays off him.
Interesting. Yeah, I would like to see that.
But yeah, so I guess enough of our wild predictions. Should we get into everyone else's wild predictions?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's jump into our pale predictions. People who have left predictions in our pale predictor form. Elliot, do you have a prediction you want to pull out first?
Yes, I've pulled out one by Sleeping Beluga, who basically has this prediction about how Child Protective Services will come and look at Verona's home life because of, you know, everything going on right now. And Sleeping Beluga's idea is that the verdict on that will be based in part on how the furs are managed. So it's, I guess, what Sleeping Beluga sort of says is, like, you know, if the furs are left to kind of soak in the ground and continue, like, amping up Kennet, then there'll be, like, harsher restrictions put on things, and it might help Verona or it might not. But if the furs are kind of resolved, then Verona's dad will get off more scot-free. So it'll kind of put Verona in this choice where, once again, the, like, innocent part of her life is at odds with the magical part, because if it's, you know, if she's getting asked to choose between, you know, handling the furs to help her home life situation in a way that's, like, doing the right thing with the furs will hurt her home life, or vice versa. Like, that's obviously, you know, we talked about this when it came up last time. It's great way to milk drama is to put the magical and the personal side of your lives at odds.
Yep.
So I like this idea from that perspective. I think that would be really fun.
Yeah, I do too. I really like, yeah, I mean, Sleeping Beluga has touched on the idea of the Canadian CPS, a lot in the past few weeks.
Well, especially the last few days.
And so I think it's an interesting thing to explore. I actually don't know if we will ever see it. I feel like it's too official to play a strong role in the story, but I'm interested to see. I do think there's a solid opposition between the magical and home lives and what Verona will do and how much Verona might do to cover it up.
This will lead into our discussion question in a sec.
So yes. We'll get to talk about this a lot. Let's touch on it a bit more there, I suppose.
What about your prediction?
I put out a prediction from user Beleg Tal, who left a few predictions, but this one I just thought was so much fun. The prediction is that Miss is the wolf, which explains why she's so cagey about being identified, why she directed Avery to the Forest Ribbon Trail first, and why she came to the promenade after Avery and Snowdrop called for Miss to attend their familiar ritual. This is one of those predictions where I don't think it's going to come true, at least not as written, but I think it touches on so many interesting like synchronicities that we have to call it out so that if it does come true, Beleg Tal gets the recognition they deserve. Because like,
I think there's problems with this, but I do really like that point about the wolf coming having something to do with Avery asking for Miss.
Yes, isn't it great? Like, also because the fact of when they're on the promenade and Avery asks the ballerina, why is the wolf showing up? And the ballerina gives this kind of like slightly cagey, hard to interpret answer that to me felt like Wabo didn't want to confirm to us the exact reason it happened. And the only reason that would make sense is if there's some reveal that is kind of hiding behind that. I don't think it's necessarily that the wolf is Miss, but like
no.
There's some indication of Miss being like a projection of the wolf or the path kind of incarnations in general or something. Like, I think that makes a lot of sense and would explain a few things in a very interesting, twisty way.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about this last week, like the way we left the promenade, I think we were both like, yeah, we're going back there because there were so many things that like felt like the first half of a reveal. Like once, yeah, like the wolf showing up was like, so there's a rule associated with that. And all we got was a yes. And it was like, yeah. Well, okay, we need to figure that
exactly,
out.
Exactly, right? It felt like there was more there. And I could see that being a reveal that we then recontextualize as the answer that the ballerina gave.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And yeah, the idea that it would tie into Miss and it was some sort of monkey's paw of trying to bring a certain lost in backfired or something, like that could work.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, should we get into our discussion question
answers? Yeah, let's get into our discussion question answers, shall we? So we've been running a discussion question for the past fortnight. The question was, what do you think the next steps are for Verona's home life? And again, there's a kind of wide variety of what people were thinking.
Yeah. We got one answer from Vice Versailles, who said, basically, while Verona is away, they think that Biscuit is going to pick Brett as their Barney.
Mm.
And then, you know, obviously Edith like won't bother to fix that up. And so, like, what this will mean is as Brett becomes a Barney, his actions will spiral and he'd lose custody of Verona, who could stay with Lucy's mom or something. But then Brett would become aware or something after that. And, yeah, then they mention, like, Verona finding a balance with her mom and all this, which is, like, this is a wild prediction. But I think the idea that Brett could become a Barney, I suppose it could work.
Yeah, I think it could work. I think it's quite interesting. There's a few like follow-on effects that Vice Versailles has like wrapped into this answer.
Yeah.
But I think it would require so many steps to go in exactly the right direction that I don't know if it's necessarily going to pan out. Like,
it's a very bold and bold and specific prediction, more so than a discussion question answer in some ways. Which,
I mean, is fine. I like the vibe. Yeah, so Verona lives with Jazz temporarily, then with her mother more permanently, which again is like could happen, but we would need to see so much specific things to make that feel right for the story, right? Like we would need to see Verona's mother take some really active steps before this would happen. And
yeah,
I don't know, that and all of these other things all happening seems a little bit unlikely to me.
I think the thing that doesn't sit right with me, and we'll probably get into this with some of the other answers, like ones that bank on something like the resolution with Brett being him turning into a Barney and basically being so magically based.
Mm.
It just doesn't. Verona's dad has always been such a non-magical adversary.
Yes.
And I think the idea of leaning into getting past that by leaning into the magic entirely. It just doesn't feel right to me.
I think the only way I would see that feeling right is if it's Verona's choice to get her dad more involved with the practice. Like, she uses magic as her solution to a mundane problem in a way that makes her life worse, invariably.
Yeah, well, because in that situation, it's more of a statement. Well, the metaphor is Verona doing something rash and stupid to get out of it.
Like, yes.
Rather than like, yeah. Like,
yeah, you know, I don't see Verona's dad just kind of like falling into something magical without active input from Verona on that.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. Like, I just think it wouldn't be as fulfilling to me if that was how it went down.
Mm. Yeah. So I wanted to pull out the answer from, well, we can pull out Lurking Beluga. I just realized it's different to the name Sleeping Beluga that they've left, but obviously the same person.
I'm 99% sure this is the same person because it's yet another plug for their fantastic Child Protective Services post.
Yes.
Which we mentioned in the prediction. But yeah, if you haven't read that, go read it. It's like a great analysis of how Child Protective Services is meant to work and how they could work for Verona if they were working.
Yeah, it a lot of it focuses on what would tangibly actually happen if the CPS was called in on this case. How would it actually play out based on the rules and regulations that they have?
I think that's the big qualifying like asterisk afterwards is like assuming CPS actually lives up to the guidelines as written, which I think is something that a lot of people would fairly call into question.
Yeah, I mean, especially because it would be dependent on like interviews with Brett and Verona and theoretically Jazz or maybe even like Lucy and Avery. I think the thing that will be interesting if this ever does happen is I suspect the motivation will be for Verona to lie in order to, or not, I guess she wouldn't be able to lie, but to, you know, misrepresent things in order to not mess up her ability to engage with the practice, especially if she has a bad time with her mum in these 2 weeks. So it's, I don't know. Lurking Beluga makes the point that if the CPS does what they would do in the real world and there wasn't any magical interference, it would probably be pretty good. And that's obviously a big qualifier to make. So we would have to see, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah.
I do think it's interesting to think of the idea that, and this comes up in a few other answers. We had, who was it? Was it Beard of Valor who talked about, having kind of mandated therapy for Verona, her dad, her mom, et cetera?
Yeah, all three of them, like individual. Family, there's a lot to be done there.
I think it's really interesting because I do think one of the things that Brett doesn't have that therapy might provide him is just somebody who's an outside objective and in a position of seniority, e.g. not a child, telling him, hey, no, you're wrong about this and that, like you're being a fuckwit. I don't know, maybe it's optimistic to think that might break through his shell, but we haven't seen it really happen. Verona has tried, but he clearly doesn't respect her opinion. I wonder if there's an opinion that he could respect telling him this and if that would be enough.
I just get the impression that Brett's the sort of person who, if they were telling him he's in any way wrong, he wouldn't respect their opinion.
I don't know
that you can get someone who he'd listen to if they're going to say that. That would be my concern with something like that. It's like, I don't see Verona's dad responding to therapy well. Just because I don't think he's, it'd take a while. Like the therapist would need to put in a lot of time to kind of crack in.
Yeah, that's true. It wouldn't be an immediate, quick solution, would it?
No. I want to call out this answer we got from Sandwich, who says, I don't think this will actually happen, but a macabre idea I had was what if they just let Bridge take Verona's dad's body?
I really, this is so good.
There's a good chance that Verona's dad's parenting while possessed by Bridge might actually improve. And this is just like the worst thing about this answer is that I don't hate it as an idea as much as I think I should.
Just like, I know.
Let's just put the fear of God into Verona's dad by having him have one of those big car crashes that makes his body unidentifiable for months.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, this dude who's barely a human will parent Verona, like, but probably still be better. Like, it's...
yeah, it's...
I hate how much I don't hate this idea.
It's wild, isn't it? I mean, I don't think it'll happen, but I think if it did, I would love to see just how fucking wild it got.
I could see Verona pitching this, honestly. Like, and just Lucy being like, we're not doing this.
She pitches it and everyone immediately says, no, Verona, that's clearly a terrible idea.
Yeah. I could totally see that scene playing out.
Yeah.
Because this does feel like the sort of thing where Verona might, like, half jokingly, like, you know, suggest it in one of her, haha, but what if?
Yeah.
And then Lucy has to sort of be like, no, 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 no. For a million reasons, no.
Yeah, yeah. I think we should touch on the thought that a few people raised. I mean, we mentioned that Vice Versailles raised it and Cal Super Blue V2 did as well, of like Jazz becoming Verona's guardian. And I just don't think that can happen realistically while VD and V-Mum are alive and, you know, like semi-capable. According to the courts, right? Like,
yeah,
it just doesn't seem like it's something that can practically happen.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree. I think it keeps popping up as an idea because everyone likes it, because it's like Jazz, good parent, Verona, need good parent. Like, it feels like a match made in heaven.
Yeah,
but it's just the system is designed to kind of not let it happen.
Yeah, for sure.
And Cal Subalu like talks about that specifically. How easy it would be for Verona's dad to sabotage Jazz if she tried to do that. It's like with that bullshit he said about how she wasn't even a good parent. Like, remember when he said that? The fucking goal.
Yeah. What an idiot. But
the sad truth is, I think he'd get away with it in certain settings.
Yeah, no, I think so too, right? Like, again, I think VD is too spiteful to let this happen, and it just wouldn't be a practical possibility while they're alive, I guess. Not to say that they should be killed, but like, it's just not going to happen.
Yeah. So we got one last answer I want to pull out was from Roundest Frog. It sort of mentions that they see, essentially you can break it down, there's three options. Verona either lives with her mum, with her dad, or she sort of is on her own or somewhere else. And obviously all three of them suck because her mum has been absent and that's probably not going to change. Like, if Verona went to live with her, she'd essentially be on her own, which I'm sure Verona would see some appeals of, but it would probably mean not being in Kennet. Her dad is obviously not an option. That's why we're here. And then so Roundest Frog is sort of like, honestly, Verona like running and living on her own actually seems like the best of these options to them. But it obviously has problems. You know, both legally and just in terms of like Verona needing guidance at her age. So Roundest Frog was suggesting maybe there's some middle ground between all three where her parents are splitting custody, but also she gets to spend time living on her own. And, you know, no idea how that would work, but that sort of, you know, feels like the closest you can get to a middle ground. But all Roundest Frog knows for certain is that whatever Wildbird does come up with will break our hearts.
Yeah. There's I don't know. Again, no happy solutions kind of problem, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't feel like there's a way out that works.
Yeah. But thank you, everybody, for brainstorming your ideas on what it could be and leaving your answers to those ideas in our discussion question/discussion threads. Just as a reminder, we're going to try and keep doing fortnightly discussion questions, so make sure you're thinking about your answers to our next discussion question. Elliot, would you like to share what it is?
Yes, so the next discussion question is, how the fuck can someone help Melissa?
Yeah.
And, you know, like, I suppose there's all sorts of wacky magical answers or whatever, but I'm curious, like, I'd almost be more interested in exploring in the real world, if you have someone like Melissa, how can you help her?
Yeah. I think we're going to see Melissa more in the next chapter or two, obviously. So I'm interested to hear, as Melissa's role in the story shifts maybe a little bit, how people's answer to this question as well might change or evolve.
Yeah, because we're going to sort of... it's so interesting that she was hanging out with the Kennetiers again in 10.C. Mm. So it's going to be curious to know exactly what her relationship with them is, based on the fact that she was out in this cabin with them. And yeah, going from there and saying, okay, well, here, how do you help this person who has nothing they're looking forward to and doesn't want help? Yeah, how do you help those people?
Mm. Yeah. So again, we're assigning a impossible question with no answer as our discussion question. So leave your impossible answers to that in our discussion thread, which you can find linked in the show notes down below.
Yes, you can also find us on Twitter. Just search Power Reflections. That's where you find out all sorts of details, like when the live reads are happening, why this episode is almost a whole day late, all sorts of things.
Yeah, all kinds of cool comments, updates, interactions on the Twitter. Also, a place to find cool comments, updates, and interactions is the Doof Media website at doofmedia.com. You can find all kinds of things about all of our shows on there, as well as kind of utility services like the calendar.
Yeah, the calendar tells you when episodes are coming out. You know, it shows you what other shows we have. Like, I've just added my streaming sessions to the game club there. So you're going to find out when you can come and play Disco Elysium with me and you know, hang out.
Yeah.
Check it out.
Yeah, definitely. If you want to support the Doof Media Network, as well as get access to all kinds of cool bonus content and additional perks, you can support us on our Patreon at patreon.com/doofmedia. You get access to all kinds of things like bonus content. We do a bonus show every single week. So there's all kinds of things you'll get access to, a whole backlog of them, in fact, as well as other perks and benefits and stuff like that.
Yeah. And don't forget to stop by Wildbo's Patreon. It's his birthday. And also, again, like we've said this before, you've listened to us talk about his story for like 2 hours. Go reward the guy if you're not doing so already.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Please do. And with that, I guess that's the end of our. Oh.
With that, we'll 10. See ya later. Get it?